You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Welcome to the programme. Lizzie, I have to admit, statistics is not my strongest subject, especially when I've been up since very early in the morning. It tends to melt my brain a bit. But I do really like getting into the where the numbers come from and how polling companies in particular manage to come up with the figures they've done. Today we're talking about the most hallowed of opinion polls, MRP, or multi-level regression with post-stratification to its friends. And this is the kind of poll that takes survey data but combines it with other information about the electorate, about things, information from the census, from government agencies, things like population density, education, stuff like that, puts it all together and gives us seat numbers. And this, in this case, MRP is pronounced bombshell, because this is giving us the poll that tells us that Labour committed over 400 seats at the next election. The Conservatives even worse off than where they were after Tony Blair's 1997 landslide. Labour becoming the biggest political party in Scotland. There's lots in this poll from YouGov.
It's not the sort of holiday reading I'd like if I were a Tory MP, but in a moment we're going to speak to the man behind that poll. It is worth considering what a Labour supermajority would look like, as these numbers are suggesting could come about. If you have Starmer's party with such a huge majority, three quarters of the Commons, it raises questions about how serious an opposition the Conservatives could be if they don't have the numerical threat to pose to the government. And then for Starmer, it could mean that you have more opposition from his own benches, a la Johnson, Truss, and now potentially Sunak. We've got Eurasia Group in a note today saying that they see a vote of confidence in Sunak after the May elections if they go as dismally as is expected. And they say Sunak would win, but Stephen, all of this is reviving my 2022 PTSD.
Well, look, it could lead to more ruckus times ahead, and no better man to explain to us exactly why this poll is coming in with such a surprise and so many levels. Patrick Inglis is Director of Political Analytics at YouGov, and he joins us in studio. Patrick, great to see you.
Hey.
With us. We don't normally make an awful lot of fuss out of just one poll, but these MRP polls are a bit different. Explain to us why this is making for so many headlines.
Yeah, as you say, this is still just one poll, and of course it's a static moment in time, but it is different to a conventional headline vote intention poll that you might see released in the press or something like that. And that's for two main reasons. One is that the sample size for a model like this is huge. So this one that we looked at is over 18,000 adults that we spoke to over the course of the month of March. And as well, the second thing is that this model is a statistical model. It's very computationally complex, and it's been proven to work. So for you, for instance, we kind of first brought it into the mainstream, I guess, in 2017, where we correctly predicted that Theresa May would be losing her majority. And then again, we used it quite recently in Spain in 2023. Again, the first that we think outside of an Anglosphere context to prove that it can work, not just in English-speaking countries. And again, we correctly predicted a hung parliament there as well, and that Pedro Sanchez would have a very good shot at remaining prime minister. So these models they're big, they're complicated, they're designed to get things right at minute levels, i.e. constituencies. And that's why I think it creates creates quite a lot of fuss and quite a lot of noise when they're released.
So I used the term brain melty and you said computationally complex. And that's why we have you with us to explain this, Patrick.
Who are the big names this time that are going to lose their seats then?
Yeah, so there's quite a few Portillo moments up and down the country. I think probably the two that stand out perhaps are the former leader of the House, Jacob Rees-Mogg. He looks to be in big trouble. Penny Mordaunt as well. Perhaps people are putting her as potential leadership challenger. Be difficult to do that from outside the House of Commons, this model we're currently projecting. You kind of look across Laetitia Davies as well, Donnellan, lots and lots of cabinet ministers going, but I think probably the Rees-Mogg and Mordaunt are the ones that I would be saying, were you up for that moment if this poll were to come to fruition?
Mm. I'm just going to remind our audience what a Portillo moment is.
Thank you.
It was, well, of course,
not to do with
trains. Merely in diapers in the 1997 election. Not really. But at 3:10 a.m, that's when Michael Portillo found out that he was losing his seat, and therefore people were saying, were you still up for Portillo? And it really signifies a monumental shift in the fortune of the ruling party.
Can you just give us an idea of how accurate this poll could be, or what is the sort of margin of error? Because I'm sure politicians will be very keen to pick holes in it.
Absolutely. I mean, as I said at the top, this is just a snapshot in time. This is what the model is saying us right now if a general election were happening tomorrow. There's not a general election happening tomorrow, right? We don't know when it's going to be. We think probably sometime in October, November. So things can change. That's one important caveat to put on it. As well, it's not like a typical poll that would have a margin of error, because we're not really assessing vote shares and we're not like looking at a sample of 2,000 people. But there will be seat ranges. And particularly when we get toward an elections, we'll say, well, we think Labour won 400 seats, but there is an implied range from the model between, let's say, 380 and 420. So that's a kind of a typical margin that we'd give for a poll like this. So even then, though, if we look at the lower bounds of the sort of seat majorities that this this model would be projecting, we're up at about 120. It's quite significant. So we're really saying that this model is pretty certain at the moment, if a general election were being held right now, Labour were doing very, very, very well indeed.
So another history lesson. How does it compare to 97?
This whole setup, yeah. I think there are two things I like to say whenever 1997 comparison is brought up. One is that in 1997, what we had then that we don't have now is a super popular opposition leader and a super popular opposition party. Tony Blair and Labour were going into that election with the full winds of public opinion behind them, right? People were looking at Blair and looking at Labour and saying, that is the next prime minister, that is the next government, that's who I want running the country. They're not doing that really with Keir Starmer. Yes, Keir Starmer's ratings are far better than Sunak's, but that's because Sunak's are quite so bad. Similarly, the Labour Party's ratings with the public are far better than the Conservatives, but that's because the Conservatives' party ratings are so very bad. So the public are not looking at this situation and going, you know, I'm ready for a Labour government. I want a Labour government. Keir Starmer is the guy I want. They're just saying, well, the Conservatives are absolutely awful. What's the alternative?
But into that void, what about the alternatives, the SNP reform?
Yeah, I think that's a good point as well, because it was 1997. We didn't have the SNP, the kind of strength that they do now, even though our poll is saying that we're projecting them to be below 20 seats in Scotland, which would be quite a remarkable result, I think, if that were to happen. Reform as well, we didn't have a reform-style party in 1997. And again, that's part of the dynamic that we're seeing here. The Conservative Party are dropping by about 20 points nationally, we think, something like that. The Labour Party are not going up by 20 points. They're only going up by about 8, 9, 10. And that's because a lot of the Conservative vote share that they're losing is going in all kinds of different directions. Yes, some of it's going to Labour, but some of it's going to Liberal Democrats. Some of it's going to Reform. A lot of it's going to Reform, in fact. And a lot of it, indeed, is going to people telling us they simply won't vote next time. So there's a really different dynamic in play here than in 1997. As you correctly say, different parties. We have a different public view of the opposition. And that creates for a different election scenario, I think, than 1997. Even though, if you look at the poll, and you look at the MRP forecasts, there's a lot of similarities in terms of what Labour are projected to be doing.
Is there any chance of any Reform MPs in your projections?
No. So the one remarkable thing about the Reform UK support is that we're estimating it at around about 10-12 kind of percent in this MRP poll, but it's quite flat across the country. It's very reminiscent of UKIP. It's we're looking at constituencies and we're seeing, you know, in quite a number of constituencies, Reform UK might be second, somewhere around 40, but they're second, you know, 10-20 points behind the winning party.
Second, not very helpful in a first-past-the-post system.
Exactly. Again, it's first-past-the-post really undermining, really kind of, let's say, putting the brakes on third parties getting through. So they may well get millions and millions and millions of votes, but there's no efficient spread of it. It's very flat across the country, and they're not really seriously challenging anybody everywhere. Interestingly, perhaps the most important seat, well, the closest that they're coming, seems to be in Ashfield, where, of course, Lee Anderson has just affected them from the Conservatives.
Mm. You mentioned the don't knows. I'm interested, given there's so much hope pinned on them, do we know more about who they're going to be demographically compared to previous elections?
Yeah, this is a group that we've been very interested in and we've done quite a lot of research on. They tend to be female, they tend to be older, they tend to be sort of financially, let's say, more secure or less insecure than some of the other voters that we're seeing, particularly ones that are moving from the Conservatives to Labour. So they're quite a specific group, and overwhelmingly, about, I think it's just in the order of about 60% of them, they tend to have voted Conservative in 2019. Now, if we're at this stage of the electoral cycle, with public opinion where it is about the Conservatives and the Labour League where it is, if these people haven't already gone over to Labour, they're quite unlikely to, we think. So it is quite likely that a disproportionate number of those don't knows, which is around about 15, 16, 17%, are probably going to go back to the Conservatives. But even so, that would not be enough to close this Labour polling lead.
Is there any prospect of the Tories being able to turn this around, or is a defeat inevitable from these numbers?
So I think the great Sir John Curtis said a 99% chance of Labour winning the next election. I have a lot of reverence for him. I think 99% is a figure he could probably get away with and I probably couldn't. but certainly the data as it is now and the way we look at it and the models that we do, the dynamics we're looking at, the shifts, the potential routes, it just seems such a narrow path for a Conservative recovery. But there are paths, right?
A tightrope?
Yeah, quite, exactly. And a lot of it involves winning back a lot of the don't knows, but it also involves winning back a lot of those people who've gone over to Reform UK. It's no good for the Conservatives if they manage to win back 60% of people who are uncertain if they've still got this 12% bloc who are standing out there and saying, I'm not voting for the Conservatives, I want Reform UK. And unlike UKIP, this is quite a difference from UKIP, the support that is being drawn from in terms of past vote for Reform UK is very strongly Conservative. There's much more of a split between the Conservatives and Labour when UKIP were coming through, but right now it really is drawing out of the Conservative support, and the Conservatives are bleeding a lot of their 2019 electoral coalition to Reform UK. So they need to be able to appeal to don't knows, they need to be able to appeal to those who are currently intending to vote for Reform, and they need to hope that some of the Labour switches as well either come back or maybe don't turn out or go to a third party. So it's just, and you know, how do you unite these tribes? How do you pull all that in? How do you do that without then surrendering the blue wall? There are so many dynamics going on here that it just makes it so very tricky for a turnaround.
Well, one solution, one path that many Conservative MPs want is to change leader. How would that impact the polling?
Yeah, I think that's a tough one. When Rishi Sunak took the position of leader and Prime Minister of the country, his personal ratings were significantly better than those of the Conservative Party. And many of us expected that what would happen was that because you had a more popular leader than the party, that the party's ratings might recover and meet him, and the Conservatives' poll ratings might recover and meet him. The opposite happened. Rishi Sunak's plummeted down toward the Conservative Party. He is now as unpopular as his party. So I think, again, changing leader, yes, you might be able to pull in a leader who the public don't have such a negative opinion of. You know, Penny Mordaunt's been thrown around, and perhaps looking at the limited evidence we have in these hypothetical scenarios suggests that she might be able to, you know, boost the Conservatives a little bit. But then over time, we may well expect that the same thing will happen again. The public simply do not like the Conservative Party. They do not trust the Conservative Party to deliver for them on issues that they care about, and that's the cost of living, it's healthcare, it's immigration, and it's climate change and housing. And they just look at the offer that the party are giving them, they're looking at the current parliamentary party, the noises that are coming out of it, and they just say, look, it's not for me. So I'm not convinced that changing leader would do all that much at this time.
Given that we don't know when the next general election is going to be, but the Conservatives seem determined to push it as late as they possibly can, is there any way that can swing to their advantage?
I think the long game is certainly being played. The evidence that we have based on our MRP poll that came out this week is that compared to January, the situation's got worse. So the long game is a bad game at the minute for the Conservatives. But I think the logic is Rishi Sunak is looking at the economy, looking at the inflation figures and thinking, well, if I can push this out to a stage where the public feel like things are getting better for them, like I've done a good job, like the economy is turning around, I can be trusted to manage the finances, I can be trusted to make them feel better off, they might reward that and they might say, well, hang on, the risk of bringing in a Labour government, the risk of, you know, spending this, that or whatever is just too great and I want to back the Conservatives. So I think that's the logic. And if it comes off, you know, the Conservatives will be very happy about that. But I think it's going to take a lot of convincing and it's going to take a lot of changing in a very short amount of time. You know, we think election, you know, in the second half of the year, this miles away. It's certainly not. That'll be here before we know it. And I'd be tough, I think, for the public to really change their minds so fast on such fundamental issues. But that's the play, I think, and that's the logic behind it.
Oh, bleak news for Rishi Sunak. All right, Patrick English, Director of Political Analytics at YouGov. Thanks so much for bringing us this data and explaining it for the two of us, not so mathematically excellent as you are.
Let's bring in our political editor, Kitty Donaldson, who's been listening into that conversation as well. Kitty, I wonder what the Westminster perspective is on this poll from YouGov. It certainly looks like very good news for Labour.
Absolutely extraordinary, and it certainly set the cat amongst the pigeons, as it were, in the Tory party, who have been running around in the last few weeks sort of panicking, throwing their hands in the air, saying we're headed for total wipeout. I think it's another thing, and it's almost worse than what will happen in the May local elections, because if the Tories lose Andy Street and Ben Houchen, two of their regional mayors, then that's already priced in. But this MRP poll is kind of new and took people by surprise. So even though Tory MPs are waiting for that poll for the local election results, that this was a kind of real kind of like wake up moment.
I mentioned Eurasia Group, Kitty, suggesting that there could be a vote of confidence after the May elections. Do you think that's a likely outcome?
I think there are lots of people in the Tory party who are extremely worried. There are a bunch of people, particularly on the right, who are agitating for a change of leader and trying to come up with some sort of formulation that puts one of their people front and centre, but they've yet to convince kind of a large majority of the centrists. Even having said that, some of the centrists are talking about it as well, about replacing Sunak. But the mechanisms are tricky for the Tory party. You need 53 letters in order to prompt a vote of confidence in his leadership. He would probably win that if it got to it, but be damaged. So the only way I think this would work at this stage is if the cabinet resigned, like they did under Boris Johnson. Of course, Rishi Sunak and Sajid Javid resigned, which prompted Boris Johnson's downfall. But I don't see who in the cabinet would resign at this point, who would sort of make the first move, because you just end up with a kind of horrid mess. And even if you know, Penny Mordaunt came in and campaigned for the last 6 months of the Tory leadership, A, would she want to, if she wants to stand for party leader after the election? I mean, it's a kind of poison chalice. People still talk about Rishi Sunak owning the defeat. So why would you, if you've got any sort of hope of being Tory party leader in opposition, why would you take that on? You might say, I'm doing it in public interest, or in the interest of the party and the public interest. But frankly, all these calculations have been gone through by their people and their teams right now.
But is there, cans of lukewarm beer being opened in Labour Party offices, though, looking at these results as well? Or are they going to be worried about that don't know factor that Patrick English was just telling us about? The idea that whereas the voters are turning away from the Conservative Party, they're not turning in their droves to the Labour Party.
Yeah, I mean, I think the chances of this MRP poll being reflected at the general election are probably quite slim. I imagine, of course, as John Curtis said, that Labour are, of course, for majority, but whether it will be this huge, it seems unlikely, I think, because some people don't actually focus on politics until the general election campaign or even the weekend before the general election. So this is very much a snapshot of where we are at the moment. I think the polls will probably narrow, as particularly reform voters turn around and go, well, I don't like the Tories, but I certainly don't want Keir Starmer government in. So the Tories will probably win some of those people back. And I'm not sure whether Keir Starmer would want a majority that big, to be honest. Like, you're talking about a completely unmanageable party. I mean, already I talked to kind of very left-wing, for want of a better description, very left-wing Labour MPs who opposed Starmer on things like Gaza, the party position on Gaza and on tax and spend and so forth, and think he should go further and faster. Those people, if there's a majority of you know, nearly 400 or over 300 will have the space and the freedom to shout a lot. And so actually discipline is slightly easier when you've kind of got a majority of, you know, a couple of hundred rather than, you know, 300, I think. So that's it. That'd be an interesting point in the autumn.
Kitty, while we've got you, one of the things that's on Sunak's plate other than these polling numbers is, of course, Thames Water. He's pressing the water supplier on the brink of a crisis to fix its financial problems alone. How's Westminster reacting to that news?
I think actually there's quite a cross-party consensus that the, you know, the regulator and Thames Water and its parent company, Kemble, should sort themselves out rather than this be any sort of burden on the taxpayer. Nobody wants, no political party, particularly any of the ones I've spoken to, wants any sort of taxpayer liability for this, particularly when you look at the dividends that were paid out over the last few years. And I think at the moment it's not really on Sunak's desk. It's not even, I don't think, on Secretary of State Steve Barclay's desk, that he's an Environment Secretary. It's been done at official level and junior ministerial level. And I think things might you know, move on in the next sort of few weeks or so as we get closer to the deadline when we might go into a sort of special administration.
Kitty Donaldson, our political editor, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to stay with the Thames Water story, though perhaps not a major worry in the political world, but certainly a major worry in the financial world. We've got Eamon Farhat, our reporter, in studio with us, who's been covering the company's recent financial troubles. Eamon, we've had two ratings agencies downgrade Thames Water's parent company, Kemble Water Finance. This is an indication of how serious the financial concerns are being taken by business. Talk us through what the latest is.
Yeah, so Kemble, the parent company of Thames Water, they have this $190 million repayment due at the end of April. Now, last week they said they'd need to get an extension on that if they were able to not default on their loans. But then this morning we had, as you said, well, last night I think we had Moody's and this morning Fitch, who said that even if they got an extension, it was probable they would still default on their loans. So the situation is, you know, moving quite quickly. And yeah, not looking good for Thames Water, whose parent company, Kemble, you know, ultimately is the one who are responsible. Now, we don't even know who Kemble actually owe this money to. You know, the creditors are kind of unknown. There were some reports in the last about half an hour that ING, the Dutch bank, was one of the people who were owed this money. And more of that will be coming, I think, later on today. But anyway, everything is very opaque and moving quite quickly. And that $190 million, although it's a small amount, it could be what, you know, catalyzes that kind of special administration and all of that at the end of the month.
And is nationalisation likely at this stage?
I think it's something that, you know, keeps being held over the government, and, you know, the investors talk about it, and it seems that there's this backstop. At the end of the day, you know, Thames Water, it's a water supplier, it's not going to fail, but the government, as Kitty was just saying, really does not want to, you know, foot the bill for this. They would like Ofwat, the regulator, they'd like Thames Water to sort it out. But, you know, it seems very, very difficult. I mean, the reason why we come to this issue is because we are now looking at huge amounts of investment needed in the water industry. I think we need about $90 billion over the next 5 years compared to about $50 billion in the last 5 years. And Thames Water, as well as many other companies, simply are struggling to try and find ways of funding this. I mean, ultimately, customers will pay in bills, but it also has to be raised in debt. And if, you know, the finances aren't there now and the investment can't be put in, then we're going to be, you know, keep having the same issue and kind of revolve around in circles.
We're you know, thinking about how this is being considered and regarded in Westminster as well. Is there much of a difference between Labour Party policy on the water companies? Of course, nationalisation was a policy under Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, exactly. So in the past, I think nationalisation would have been quite popular for Labour. I think it was last year or the year before where Rachel Reeves dropped that policy and now really wants to kind of keep it more as a private sector thing and, you know, really get resolved by the regulator, similar to what, you know, the Conservatives are saying. I guess at the end of the day, Labour does not want to burden the public with this either. However, you know, we have actually a meeting this afternoon with the unions and with the water company, and they actually are kind of on a very different side to Labour. Although we obviously have the unions and Labour kind of quite supportive at the moment, the unions are very kind of pro-nationalisation, and some parts of the Labour Party would be as well. I think it is quite a common sense thing for a lot of the public. The polling does show that it's quite popular, but also, as we know, for the public, it's, you know, the economy, it's cost of living that important, and they don't want to be burdened with even more issues like Thames Water and other water companies.
Yeah, it's interesting to just link it back to our conversations with Kitty and Patrick, because if Labour got the sizeable majority that Patrick was suggesting in his polling, and where Kitty says that could be a bit of a nightmare for Starmer because a lot of those MPs could be quite left-wing, then you would have lots of support for nationalisation. So my question to you, Eamon, is there time for Thames Water to stick around until after a potential Labour victory, potentially after an election in the autumn.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, this whole thing kicked off last summer. You know, it keeps kind of
coming in waves almost.
Yeah, we keep putting plasters on
trips
it
and drabs.
Exactly. I mean, every time there's a repayment that keeps being plasters, you know, Ofwat is releasing little bits about their next investment plan. So all of this really affects Thames Water and the investors. So it's very possible that we're kind of in this mess for even longer, and that it's Labour who have to kind of make the decision about, is it special administration, is it something else, or how do you deal with the situation of Thames Water, and is it the public that foots the bill?
What do we know about those talks with unions and Thames Water?
So it's mostly about job cuts. I mean, that's obviously what the unions are quite worried about. You know, last year we had about 300 job cuts from Thames. So we have GMB, Unison, Unite all meeting with Thames Water and trying to get some reassurance, I guess. I mean, at the end of the day, these unions are still saying that even if you get a bit of cuts here and there in jobs and save some money, it won't fix the issue. It still means that there's a huge, you know, fiscal hole for the company. So it doesn't really make sense. And they want to obviously, you know, get their members reassured. But they are very pro-nationalisation and they want to try to kind of push that idea forward. And at the end of the day, they really just think that it's a big mess that, you know, shouldn't be burdened by their own employees.
All right, Eamon Farhart, swimming through the detail for us on the latest on Thames Water. Thank you for joining us in the studio.
Well, Lizzie, I think we've got today both a very precedent and present political issue in the water companies and how the government's going to react in that, but then also the perspective of how things could look very different in less than a year's time, depending on whenever that election comes, because that poll has really, you know, repainted perhaps what people had been considering, you know, as we were hearing from Patrick English, yes, very much a Labour majority being thought of as being practically inevitable at this stage, but not a majority of this size.
Yeah, so the Conservatives hope. So they've been saying for quite a number of months, waiting for the economic situation to turn round, but particularly on the inflation front, it's incredibly sticky here in the UK.
Certainly is, and that's a conversation for another day. That's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe, give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo and James Wilcock. Our audio engineer was Sean Guastamacchia, and I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.